We hope this explanation of God's Word enriches your life. To help you understand the audience for this talk, we suggest you read the context material on the About Us page. Please read also our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material from philipjensen.com. This talk was recorded at the lunchtime campus Bible study, where it was delivered for university students.
Well, thank you, Sam. We turn again to the book of Ecclesiastes. And today we're going to look at chapters 7 to 9. I'm not going to read it through sequentially as I did on the other days, as I take it that you now can see how you can take bits and pieces out of the book, because it doesn't flow sequentially like an argument that goes from A to Z but works its way around, repeating and quoting itself and then arguing and advancing and dropping back. But also, we need to warn you that all the time the truths in Ecclesiastes are not final. That is, I'll be taking quite a few quotes from chapter 7 to 9. I'll read most of it, in fact, but won't be just doing it in order. But I want to warn you about the great danger of quoting from Ecclesiastes. And let me illustrate it to you with a couple of truths. For example, if you look at chapter 7, verse 7:16, we read, "Do not be over-righteous, neither be over-wise. Why destroy yourself?" Now, of course, the key question is how over is over. But nonetheless, here is a part of the Bible telling you not to be righteous. Here is a part of the Bible not encouraging you to any kind of zeal in righteousness, but in fact, encouraging you to avoid all extremes, verse 18. Or again, if you look at chapter 7, verse 28, you'll read the chauvinist verse of the Bible. "While I was still searching, but not finding, I found one upright man among a thousand, but not one upright woman among them all." Some people, of course, argue that he shouldn't be looking at a thousand different women, that he should have just stuck with his wife and then he wouldn't have had the problem. But nonetheless, you see from that verse, you can really be establishing a difference between men and women that you may or may not want to be establishing. Or chapter 8, verse 15, "So I commend the enjoyment of life, because nothing is better for a man under the sun than to eat and drink and be glad." So you see, here's the Bible, which teaches against eat, drink and be merry, for tomorrow we die, teaching us to eat, drink and be merry, for that's the best thing that's going for us. Now, you can prove anything you want to from the book of Ecclesiastes. That's the trouble with this part of the Bible. You can demonstrate anything if you take verses, if you're a verse quoter, because Ecclesiastes, the author, plays with ideas. He throws them out and thinks about them and sees their consequences, then moves to another one and thinks about that. And it's not until you reach the end of the book, or not until you look at a large slab, that you can actually understand what his point is. And to pick one verse or one sentence from somewhere in the game of ideas is not telling you the final answer. The end of the book, which we look at next week, God willing, we'll see the final answer. And in a slab as big as we're dealing with today, chapter 7 to 9, we'll see something of final answers. But in individual verses, why, you can prove anything. So beware. The main idea that he is investigating in chapter 7 to 9, but throughout the book as a whole, is wisdom. Thank you, Sam. The whole book's looking at it, that is the wisdom of Israel. You get wisdom literature in the Bible, in the book of Job, parts of Psalms, Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon's and the like. But wisdom claims that this is the best way to live. But the problem with wisdom is that its claims don't seem to bear out in fact. For wisdom will teach that there will be reward for the righteous and punishment for the wicked. But you can see the problem of Job, can't you? He lives a righteous life and seems to be punished. And his friends, they can come and say to him, "You must have done something evil because, look, you're being punished." And Job says, "I've done nothing to deserve this." And he hasn't. And so the wisdom literature challenges the very notion of wisdom as to what is wisdom about and what value is wisdom. Because if you look at the world, the great hypothesis of wisdom doesn't seem to hold up. So in the section we have today, it starts with the question of where wisdom is found. Not as the world superficially thinks, in life, in prosperity, in parties and in song, or even at the university, but in death, in funerals, in mourning, and in rebuke. Chapter 7. A good name is better than fine perfume, and the day of death is better than the day of birth. It's better to go to a house of mourning than to a house of feasting. For death is the destiny of every man, and the living should take this to heart. Sorrow is better than laughter, because a sad face is good for the heart. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of the fool is in the house of pleasure. It is better to heed a wise man's rebuke than listen to the song of fools. Like the crackling of thorns under the pot, so is the laughter of fools. This too is meaningless. Extortion turns a wise man into a fool, and a bribe corrupts his heart. The end of a matter is better than its beginning, and patience is better than pride. Do not be quickly provoked in your spirit, for anger resides in the lap of the fools. Do not say, why were the old days better than these? For it's not wise to ask such a question. Wisdom is found at the end of things, not at the beginning of things, in the outcome of things, in particularly in life itself. It's not in the beginning that you find wisdom, at the birth, at the party. It's at the end, at the death, at the wake. That is where wisdom is to be found. Wisdom evaluates the activities of life after the event. It's not wise to be saying, oh, look, the old days were the good days. The old days always look to the good days when people have lost them and are older. No, this is the day that you must deal with, and this day that you need to deal with, why, you will learn how to deal with it if you think in reality. And the reality is the death of everyone. The reality is your death. It's death which is the great teacher. The cemetery, the funeral parlour, that is the great teacher. Parties are great fun, but they are meaningless, futile, mindless. Enjoyable, he's not saying don't go to parties, but don't expect to learn anything from parties. But walk through the cemetery, read the tombstones, sit down and think about it. Realise that one day someone will be sitting on your grave thinking about it. And realise what life is about. It's death. Now this kind of wisdom that you will gain, this wisdom is valuable. What does it do? Well, see, it's not like party foolishness where you enjoy a meaningless life. Wisdom preserves life like a shelter. It's more valuable than money, the security that most of our society tries to hide behind, verses 11 and 12. Wisdom, like an inheritance, is a good thing and benefits those who see the sun. Wisdom is a shelter as money is a shelter. But the advantage of knowledge is this, that wisdom preserves the life of its possessor. See, wisdom teaches us about our life and the future. But one of the things it teaches about our life and the future is that it's all out of our control. Verse 13, consider what God has done. Who can straighten what he has made crooked? When times are good, be happy. When times are bad, consider. God has made the one as well as the other. And therefore a man cannot discover anything about his future. See, the only thing you know of your future is the grave that you're going to occupy. You don't know which grave, even. You don't know. It mightn't be a grave. You might be sent to a cemetery, or you might die at sea. You don't know very much except death. You do not know your future. And so although wisdom can preserve life, and wisdom is more valuable to protect you than money, yet wisdom doesn't actually help you in the end, because there's nothing about your future that you can know except your death. Wisdom teaches that the righteous suffer and the wicked prosper. Verse 15, in the meanest life of mine I have seen both these, a righteous man perishing in his righteousness and a wicked man living long in his wickedness. And therefore, what should you do? Well, his answer is, avoid extremes. Live by the golden mean. You see, if you're really righteous, you're not going to live any longer. If you're really wicked, you're not going to live any shorter. What's going to happen is going to happen, irrespective of how you live. That's what wisdom would teach you. Therefore, verse 15, 16, do not be overrighteous, neither be overwise. Why destroy yourself? Don't be over wicked. Don't be a fool. Why die before your time? It's good to grasp the one and not let go of the other. The man who fears God will avoid all extremes. See, I learn wisdom from death, from the end of matters, and I look and I say, well, death comes when death comes. Who knows when it's going to come? You can't control the future. And so there's no point living now in such a fashion as to make sure that you are going to control your future, because you can't control your future. So don't stress, don't sweat, don't strain, don't be too righteous, don't be too wicked, don't be too wise, don't be too foolish, just be Australian. Lie back, enjoy it, go with the flow, because you don't know what's going to happen to you and when it's going to happen to you. Called in to see my neighbour the other night. He's just come out of hospital after an operation. A brain tumour, a very serious and massive operation. She's 23. She's just finished university. Is she more wicked than you? No. Is she more righteous than you? No. Is she cleverer than you? Well, she's finished uni, but that doesn't prove anything. Well, but she's not 65, she's not 75, she's not 85, she's your age, not my age. It's not fair, it's not just, it's not right, but hey, where's justice, fairness, rightness got to do with life? Go to the end of life and you will see there's no justice, there's no fairness, there's no rightness. There's no wisdom that will in the end protect you. You may as well just go with the flow, be fatalistic, accept what comes. What comes is what comes. That is, wisdom is a powerful, practical attribute, but it's not a final one. Wisdom is like a degree in business administration. It's not the meaning of life, but it's the way of getting things done. It is a powerful, and it makes its owners powerful, and in our society, wealthy. It's more powerful than being the ruler of 10 cities, but it's not the answer to life. No one, you know that no one is righteous, and therefore you live on the basis of the fact that no one's righteous. You know that everybody being unrighteous curse people when they don't mean to say things that are bad about people, but they just do it. You've done it yourself. And therefore you know not to listen to what other people have to say, because, hey, everybody shoots their mouth off sometime. Everybody says bad things they shouldn't have said. You're an idiot if you listen. Because if you listen, you'll have someone say bad things about you, and then you'll get all hurt and huffy and have a hissy fit and the rest. And you shouldn't be bothered with that, because, hey, that's the character. See, verse 19, wisdom makes one wise man more powerful than ten rulers of a city. There is not a righteous man on earth who does what is right and never sins. Do not pay attention to every word people say, or you may hear your servant cursing you. For you know in your heart that many times you yourself have cursed others. You see, wisdom teaches you what life is like, what people are like, and knowing what people are like and what life is like, you are able to live in accordance with it, in harmony with it. But to live in harmony with it is not to listen to what other people have got to say too much, is not to be too wise, not to be too righteous. Wisdom gives you many practical lessons of life. Come with me back to the book of Proverbs for a moment and just show you, because the book of Proverbs is a book of wisdom. Come to chapter 24. It's the book just in front of Ecclesiastes. And I thought of a verse that just to illustrate this, and then I realised, well, I might as well give you a whole batch of verses there. Chapter 24, verse 27. Finish your outdoor work and get your fields ready. After that, build your house. Now, that's the wisdom of the Bible, and it's the exact opposite to the wisdom of Australian economic life for the middle class Australia. Because what we do is we buy our houses first, get ourselves into massive mortgage, and then we work in debt for the rest of our lives. So the wisdom says go the other way. Get your business up and running. If you've got your business up and running, it'll pay for many houses, so you don't have to worry about it, you see. There's a wisdom to life, how to live, how to make the best of your circumstances of life. Advice for young graduates there, verse 27. But there's lots of advice. 28, do not testify against your neighbour without cause, or use your lips to deceive. Do not say, I'll do to him as he has done for me. I'll pay that man back for what he did. I went past the field of a sluggard, past the vineyard of the man who lacks judgment. Thorns had come up everywhere. The ground was covered with weeds. The stone walls were in ruins. I applied my heart to what I observed and I learnt a lesson from what I saw. A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest, and poverty will come on you like a bandit and scarcity like an armed man. So there's wisdom. If you're lazy, you can expect to go downwards. Busyness is what you are called to. Hard work, diligence is... See, the book of Proverbs, the book of wisdom, is full of the wisdom of how to live in this world. Good, practical advice, but not ultimate answers. Not what it's about. Not where life is going or why life's going. Hints that will make you powerful in life if you put them into practice. In particular, wisdom knows the right time to do things. Come back to Ecclesiastes chapter 8. Ecclesiastes 8, I know I've skipped a bit, but don't worry, I'll get back to it. Who is like the wise man? Who knows the explanation of things? Wisdom brightens a man's face and changes his heart appearance. Obey the king's command, I say, because you took an oath before God. Do not be in a hurry to leave the king's presence. Do not stand up for a bad cause, for he will do whatever he pleases. Since a king's word is supreme, who can say to him, "What are you doing?" Whoever obeys his command will come to no harm, and the wise heart will know the proper time and procedure. For there is a proper time and a procedure for every matter, though a man's misery weighs heavily upon him. Since no man can know the future, who can tell him what is to come? No man has power over the wind to contain it. No one has power over the day of his death, as no one is discharged in time of war, so wickedness will not release those who practice it. So you see, there are some things that are permanent in life. Wickedness, death. But there are other things in life that have a timing. Getting things done at court. Knowing the right time to speak to the king and the wrong time to speak to the king. And the right way of speaking, the right procedure, the right channels to go through. Now, a wise man is a man who understands the time and who acts in accordance with the situations of life. He's not an idealist racing like a martyr to the stake. He's a pragmatist, a politician, who weighs up the moment and will win because of his wisdom. You need it in life, friends. You need it in the offices that you're going to go and work in. You need it in the government that you're going to go and work in. You need it in the university you're going to go and work in. For the people who rise to the top are rarely the people who are the best at doing the job. The people who rise at the top are the best at knowing how the system works, are the best at knowing when to put the application in and when to hold their mouth, when to help the boss see that he's making a complete ass of himself and when to let him go and make an ass of himself, when to speak and when to spar. Timing is of the essence of your climbing up through the labyrinth of power. And a good courtier, a wise courtier, knows how to make the system work for him, for his benefit. That's what wisdom does for you. Master in business administration. It is the course of human wisdom. But of course it's terribly limited, for we're not omniscient. We know and understand only some things, and our limitations reduce the value of wisdom considerably. Look back in chapter 7:23. All this I tested by wisdom, and I said, I'm determined to be wise, but this was beyond me. Whatever wisdom may be, it was far off and most profound. Who can discover it? So I turned my mind to understand, to investigate, to search out wisdom and the scheme of things, and to understand the stupidity of wickedness and the madness of folly. I find more bitter than death the woman who is a snare, whose heart is a trap and whose hands are chains. The man who pleases God will escape her, but the sinner will ensnare. Look, says the teacher, this is what I discovered. Adding one thing to another, discovered of the scheme of things, while I was still searching but not finding, I found one upright man among a thousand, but not one upright woman among them all. This only have I found. God made mankind upright, but men have gone in search of many schemes. See, it's all beyond him. He wished to be wise, but it was beyond him. Not because he was stupid, not because he was unintelligent, but because wisdom was far off, verse 24, and cannot be found. He tries persistently in verses 25 to 28, but notice verse 28, while I was still searching, but not finding. His view on men and women is not his final finding. That's what he actually was not finding. And in this context, his comparison is not between men and women, but between humans and their own failure and success rates There's not one in a thousand. There is one in a thousand. One in a thousand is not a very good strike rate. His conclusion that he does find is verse 29. There's only one thing I did find: the universal perversity of human morality. God made mankind upright, but men have gone in search of many schemes. That's the only thing he found. Sin everywhere. And another dead end for him was the way in which the wicked prosper. Verse 12 of chapter 8. Although a wicked man commits 100 crimes and still lives a long time, I know that it will go better with God-fearing men who are reverent before God, yet because the wicked do not fear God, it will not go well with them, and their days will not lengthen like a shadow. There is something else meaningless that occurs on the earth. Righteous men who get what the wicked deserve, wicked men who get what the righteous deserve. And this too, I say, is meaningless. So here is a meaning for wisdom, a meaning that he is sure of. The wicked will get their punishment, the righteous will get their reward. But I look around the world and the wicked are getting what the righteous deserve and the righteous are getting what the wicked deserve. How can it be? You look at the moguls of the 1980s who made enormous quantities of money and still live free. Free people. You can think of men like Idi Amin, who massacred thousands upon thousands of his fellow countrymen in Uganda. He still lives as a free man, unpunished for the crimes that he did. You look at the Chilean president, still free. You can look at, so it goes on. Rarely do these people ever seem to get punished. And yet, righteous people. So where is this wisdom, this morality? Here is the dead end for them, that his observations of life do not match the hypothesis of wisdom. And so he concludes, verse 15, there's only one thing to do, eat, drink and be merry. For there's no morality, there's no justice, there's no correlation between desert and outcome, so you may as well eat and drink, there's nothing else to do. Joy will accompany him in his work all the days of his life that God has given him because he's out there enjoying. Party on, friends, party on. Even though, if you remember where we started, the party is the cackling of fools. The party is the noise of the timber crackling in the fire under the pot. It's stupid, it's meaningless, it's futile, it's empty, it's vain. You'll never learn anything in the party. Now, be wise. And by the time he's finished two chapters, his wisdom has taught him, go to the party. Because there's nothing out there to be wise about except death. And it's random. And it's meaningless. It leads him to see that wisdom as beyond all people's understanding. Verse 16, chapter 8. When I applied my mind to know wisdom and to observe man's labour on earth, his eyes not seeing sleep day or night, then I saw all that God had done. No one can comprehend what goes on under the sun. Despite all his efforts to search it out, man cannot discover its meaning. Even if a wise man claims he knows, he cannot really comprehend it. Remember Socrates, friends, as Plato wrote him up. Socrates was the man who knew that he was the smartest man on earth because he knew one fact, which put him one fact ahead of everybody else, because the one fact he knew was that he didn't know anything. That's one-upmanship of an extreme nature, but that was the starting point for Socrates' wisdom. But since the 18th century, that has not been the starting point of people. Since the 18th century, our enlightenment, and you can trace it back into the ancient Greeks, if you like, with Protagoras, so man is the measure of all things, the things that are and the things that are not, but since the 18th century, Western culture and civilization has taken an extreme turn away from God and towards man. Man has replaced God. You see it in the atheist poem by A.C. Swinburne, Hymn to Man, where he makes fun of a great hymn to God. Glory to man in the highest, because man is the master of things. It was the machine age that dominated the Enlightenment thinking, late 18th through the 19th century. It was the machine that dominated their thinking, like the computer is dominating our thinking today. The computer is changing the way in which we read, the way in which we communicate, the way in which we write, the way in which we spell or don't spell. The machine of the 18th century gave man a sense of mastery over the world that he never had before. And so it was considered that man would rule the world. Here is the great definition of man that came in part from the Humanist Association. Carl Becker in The Heavenly City, the 18th century philosophers, puts it down this way. Man is not natively depraved. The end of life is life itself, the good life on earth, instead of the beatific life after death. Man is capable, guided solely by the light of reason and experience, of perfecting the good life on earth. The first and essential condition to the good life on earth is the freeing of men's minds from the bonds of ignorance and superstition, and their bodies from the arbitrary oppression of the constituted social authorities. That is, from the church and from the aristocracy. For here we have the kind of thinking that led to the French Revolution. Here we had the thinking of the whole 19th century agnosticism and atheism, that we are not natively depraved, that there is no life after death that we're living for, but that man, by reason, by experience, by empiricism and rationalism, will be able to conquer all things, because glory to man in the highest. Man is the master of all things. You get it in crass kind of little comments, not realizing where it comes from, or possibly like JF Kennedy. All men's problems are created by man and can be solved by man. All man's problems can be solved by man. It reminds me of a politician in Australia who once said there'll be no children in poverty. No, we can do it. James McClelland was an Australian politician. He was in the Whitlam government. He was a judge. He was a journalist and an author and one of Sydney's intellectuals. He died, I think, last year. It could have been the year before. I'm not quite sure. He was a great friend and ally Mr. Justice Murphy, and the journalists after McClelland died said that several key journalists said that McClelland admitted that he knew about Murphy's guilt, but nobody ever asked him at the right time and the right place, so he didn't tell them. But he knew that his little mate had actually done the wrong thing, which is pretty sad, friends, because the High Court Judge Lionel Murphy was involved, if it is true, in terrible corruption in our society, having private telephone conversations with one of the Mr. Bigs of sin of our society. So McClelland was a mixed bag. Of course, unfortunately, the journalist said after he was dead, so he can't contradict it. But McClelland was a keen atheist who, with Lionel Murphy, when anyone was swearing an oath in government, he would try and persuade them to just give an affirmation because he was so committedly atheistic. He wrote, "At the age of 17, I turned my back on God forever." And he also said, "What is the meaning of life?" Well, I've never found the answer to that one. "But I have discovered that life is worth living and worth trying to live well, even if it has no meaning. Life is its own justification." One local professor complained that some of the more outrageous political doctrines of our time, some of the fascist policies of the early part of the century, are based on some extent, among intellectuals at any rate, on this view that you must create your own values and live by them regardless of the consequences. Life has no meaning, therefore I give it the meaning that I want to give it. I decide what should be and shouldn't be, because I am the master of life, of everything. McClelland said it this way, "I agree with most of the Judeo-Christian ethic, shorn of its supernatural trappings. I can see no reason why we can't have one without the other." Indeed, he was suggesting, the course I'm suggesting, ethics without theology for senior high school, should be factual and scientific and calculated to arouse the interests of inquiring young minds. See, here's the atheistic, humanistic ideal. Take control of the school system. Turn it into secularist institutions, such as meaning by secularist anti-God, which the word didn't mean when it was established in the 19th century, but it now means. And on the basis just of science and rationality of reason, solve men and women's problems by the thought. But of course, you can't divorce Christianity and its ethics. Nietzsche put it right, when one gives up the Christian faith, one pulls the right to Christian morality out from under one's feet. This morality is by no means self-evident. Christianity is a system, a whole view of things thought out together. By breaking one main concept out of it, the faith in God, which is a pretty main one, one breaks the whole of it and it stands or fails with faith in God. The idea that you're going to be able to continue with a Christian ethic, the Christian motivation, the Christian worldview, the Christian understanding without God is an absurdity. Nietzsche was right. If God is dead, God is dead. And if God is dead, then we've got to make up our own ethics. Whatever ethics you want to make up, you make up. One of the great fans of Nietzsche put it this way, because he was interested in science and he was interested in rationality, and he said, if nature does not wish that weaker individuals should mate with stronger, she wishes even less that a superior race should intermingle with an inferior. Why? Because in such a case, her efforts throughout hundreds and thousands of years to establish an evolutionary higher stage of being may thus be rendered futile. That, of course, was our dear friend Adolf, who gave Mussolini's copy of Nietzsche, because he was so keen on this understanding. You pull out God, you pull out ethics. You pull out ethics, you do what nature tells you to do. Well, that's what nature tells you to do, isn't it? Breed selectively. Let the weak go to the wall. That is the character of, isn't it? See, here is the arrogance of man. There's a book published a couple of years ago called The Brief History of Time, written by Stephen Hawking. It's one of the most widely published and purchased books in the world that has been read by almost nobody. Because though it aimed to make cosmology and mathematics and physics simple, it failed. However, it finished with a great paragraph and a great quote, which goes, "However, if we do discover a complete theory, then we shall be able to take part in the discussion of the question why it is that we and the universe exist. And if we find the answer to that, it would be the ultimate triumph of human reason, for then we would know the mind of God." See, that is the goal of human wisdom, to be God. But yet, we fail completely, friends. No man can understand it all. Socrates. But yet, we fail completely, friends. No man can understand it all. Socrates is closer to the truth. We do not know. So back to Ecclesiastes, and to our author sees one fact clearly, that is our common destiny, chapter 9. So I reflected on all this and concluded that the righteous and the wise and what they do in God's hands, but no man knows whether love or hate awaits him, all share a common destiny, the righteous and the wicked, the good and the bad, the clean and the unclean, those who offer sacrifices, those who do not. As it is with a good man, so it is with a sinner. As it is with those who take oaths, so with those who are afraid to take them. This is the evil in everything that happens under the sun. The same destiny overtakes all. The hearts of men, moreover, are full of evil. And there is madness in their hearts while they live, and afterwards they join the dead. It is the evil that all alike should receive the same punishment, death. The wise and the foolish, the good and the sinner. It makes nonsense of all endeavours. It makes nonsense of all our efforts. Yet there is no getting away from this fact. Adolf Hitler is dead, but so is Winston Churchill. The monster and the hero have the same fate. The cowboy in the white hat and the cowboy in the black hat, neither of them ride off into the sunset with the girl. Both of them reside in Boot Hill. And there are not so many heroes in white hats. Look at the second half of verse 3. How different the assessment of the Enlightenment humanism, whose first point was that man is not natively depraved. That's point number one. That we will be clever enough to work it all out, that there is nothing to life except this life, and we are good, we are moral. Ecclesiastes is saying we are immoral, and this life, if that's all there is, doesn't make sense. And we will never make sense of it. The exact reverse is the message of Ecclesiastes, which fits the bill. Do you expect all people to be good? Or do you lock your car and your house? Now, the reality, of course, is we do not expect people to be good. When someone does something wrong, you say, well, it's only human. Why do we say it's only human if it's not that we know that everybody makes mistakes, moral mistakes. And so death is ultimately meaninglessness. Verses 4 to 6. Anyone who is among the living has hope. Even a live dog is better than a dead lion, for the living know that they will die, but the dead know nothing. I mean, I don't know much, but at least I know I'm going to die. Dead man doesn't even know that. They have no further reward, and even as the memory of them is forgotten, their love, their hate, their jealousies have long since vanished. Never again will they have a part in anything that happens under the sun. Anything alive is better than death. And so his conclusions are again fatalistic hedonism. Eat, drink and be merry, for there's nothing else. Go eat in food and gladness and drink your wine with a joyful heart, for it's now that God favours what you do. Always be clothed in white, always anoint your head with oil, enjoy life with your wife whom you love all the days of your meaningless life that God has given you under the sun, all your meaningless days, for this is your lot in life and in your toilsome labour under the sun. And even more infuriatingly meaningless is that chance and time governs everything. Verses 11 and 12. I've seen something else under the sun. The race is not to the swift or the battle to the strong, nor does the food come to the wise or wealth to the brilliant or favour to the learned. But time and chance happen to them all. Moreover, no man knows when his hour will come. As fish is caught in a cruel net or birds taken in a snare, so men are trapped by evil times that fall unexpectedly upon them. Everything in the end is a fluke, friends. You just happen to be at the right time, at the right place, to find out. Now, that's how you'll get your jobs. That's how you'll get your promotions. That's how you'll do whatever it is. Just fluke. You turned up to the library just when they put that book back, which you needed to pass that essay, which gave you just that mark, which enabled you to get just that job, which gave you just that overseas trip because the company was just expanding at the moment. You turned in and it all was just a matter of fluke and chance outside of your control. And this would be enough to leave you in complete meaningless despair. But yet wisdom is superior than strength. So the last little section of chapter 9, verses 13 to 18, I also saw that under the sun this example of wisdom that greatly impressed me. There was once a small city with only a few people in it, and a powerful king came against it, surrounded it, and built huge siege works against it. Now there lived in that city a man poor but wise, and he saved the city by his wisdom. But nobody remembered that poor man. So I said, wisdom is better than strength, but the poor man's wisdom is despised, and his words are no longer heeded. The quiet words of the wise are more to be heeded than the shouts of the ruler of fools. Wisdom is better than weapons of war, but one sinner destroys much good. See, wisdom is superior to strength. This little poor man, unknown, unsung, saved the city against the powerful king. Wisdom has the capacity for living that folly doesn't. So it's better to be wise than foolish. It's better to be a wise poor man than a foolish, powerful king. And yet in this world, who remembers the poor, wise man? All remember the foolish, powerful king. One sinner can do so much damage. So what hope is there in a world dominated by death? For death dominates all our existence, friends, making a mockery of all that we do and all that we are and of us. And in one sense, here we are no better off than the author. For we sit here, most of us young enough to feel death is a long way away, and yet with no knowledge of our future other than death, or as the death diary says, taxes and death. There is no other future. So in your planning your future, in your dreaming your future, in your hoping your future, what part does death play? Well, I don't have to plan that, don't have to dream it, it'll come anyway, but what do I learn from the fact that I'm only going to live in order to die? You see, the wise take it to heart. But when you are wise and take it to heart, what does that mean you do? Don't be too wise, don't try too hard, you're going to die anyway. Or forget about it, eat, drink and be merry, you're going to die anyway. Is that the wise? Well, that's foolishness. Partying is foolishness. Not wrong, just foolish. So, is there advantage in wisdom? Yes. The wise person does save the city. The wise person does shelter himself. The fool dies early. The sluggard doesn't have the crops. So there is value in wisdom. You do know when to speak to the king. You do know how to do the right thing at the right time. There's value in it. But it doesn't solve your problems. But in another sense, we here are in a better situation than the author of Ecclesiastes. For we have the hope of the gospel. We live this side of the death and resurrection of the Lord Jesus Christ, which he didn't live. He was on the other side before it had all happened. And see, without the gospel of Jesus, death reigns supreme. And its reign is so great as to make life itself meaningless. Even when we know that there is a meaning somewhere, for wisdom is clearly a superior to folly, it just doesn't tell us anything because of death. Oh, that someone would come here and conquer death, would open up to us existence beyond the grave. For if there was existence beyond the grave, that would change the whole nature of life. If there was a beatific life after death, then the nature of what life is about now would be dramatically and radically changed. There was one man. He was Jesus. For Jesus was crucified and Jesus rose from the dead. Now that opens up to us a whole nature of life beyond the grave. Friends, I don't know whether you know about the death of Jesus and his resurrection. I don't know whether you believe in it or not. Let's assume that there are some people here who know nothing about it or next to nothing about it, and there are some people here who do know about it but don't believe in it, and there are some people here who believe in it. I want to talk especially to the first two groups, those who don't know much about it and those who don't believe in it. For even if you don't believe in it or don't know much about it, do you see what enormous significance it would hold? You see, if the author of Ecclesiastes is right, life is meaningless because of the grave, anybody who can come and deal with the grave is somebody worth listening to, isn't it? For if he does truly deal with the grave, if he does conquer death, if he does overcome death and our death and your death and my death, why, that opens up a whole range of meaningfulness in our existence, a whole purposeful life in our existence that I never have if the only thing available to me is a coffin. If the only thing available to me is a quick trip up the crematorium flue. You see why Jesus is so important in his dealing with death. Now, he may not have conquered death, and we may still be locked into meaninglessness like Ecclesiastes. But those of us who are here who believe in the conquest of death by Jesus would want to assure you that it's worth studying carefully. Because if it is true, it changes everything in life. And we believe it is true. Because he was seen, because people was witnessed, because it was recorded for us, because of who he was and because of why he died. Death and its meaninglessness is conquered by the gospel of Jesus. We want you to keep studying it. We're glad that you're with us. And I hope you'll see that it is worthwhile and important to study this matter. Even if at the end of the day you come to the conclusion, no, it's wrong, he never conquered death. At least you've studied something that gave a bright glimmer of hope in a hopeless world. But more, he dealt with our wickedness also. For you see, Ecclesiastes has these two things in it, doesn't it? The wisdom has taught him, one, death everywhere and therefore meaningless, and two, immorality everywhere, wickedness everywhere. No one doing the right thing. Jesus' death overcomes mortality because Jesus' death deals with wickedness. For he didn't die his death, he died our death as a sacrifice for sins, so that the justice of God could be delivered and at the same time guilty people like you and I can be forgiven. And therefore the meaninglessness that comes out of the wicked prospering and the righteous suffering is again transformed, because final justice takes place when the righteous will be rewarded and the wicked will be punished. For in the death of Jesus, God deals with wickedness. The apparent injustice and wickedness of this world is dealt with in the cross of Jesus. So the two problems that the author of Ecclesiastes sees, and are not so hard to see in the world around about you, the two problems of meaninglessness because of wickedness and meaninglessness because of immorality or amorality, are both dealt with in the cross and resurrection of Jesus. Later in the session, we're going to be looking at John's Gospel so as to look at the person of Jesus, for that is where the answer is for the book of Ecclesiastes. But next week we look at chapters 10 to 12, for the author of Ecclesiastes has something of an answer there which we need to come to. A surprising answer, in fact, a shocking answer. But that's next week. Now you'll see on the end of your outlines there's a tear-off strip which I've torn off mine so I can't do it now, but if we all tear it off together it makes that wonderful noise that we can do in unison. And if you've been here before, you only need to put your name and tick the little box up the top there about having been here before. But if you haven't been, please put the details so that we can keep in contact with you. But on the back, write whatever questions, comments you would like. I like the feedback, and that's why we're doing the cards at the end, not at the middle of or beginning of the studies now, so that you can give whatever feedback you want to there. And on the way out, there'll be ushers who can collect them from you. And we do serve free tea and coffee outside in that direction. And it's a great help to the flow of traffic in CLB if you go out the front doors, not the back doors. Let me close in prayer. Heavenly Father, we do thank you for your Son and his death and resurrection, that in his conquest of evil is the conquest of death, so that not only do we come to a life eternal through him, but life here under the sun can find its true meaningfulness. We pray, Father, for those amongst us who do not know and who are uncertain or who doubt Jesus' death and resurrection, that you'd help them to find the information necessary to know this of a truth. We pray for those of us who know of this, Father, that we may not know it on frail and weak basis, but that we might understand the truth properly. We do thank you, Father, for what Jesus has done for us, and we pray that his death and resurrection may illuminate all our...
Thank you for listening to the talks on philipjensen.com. Please check our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material on philipjensen.com.